It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, our guest says we should have a record-breaking hiking trail going all the way around the coasts of the entire Great Lakes.
First, a young white man opened fire on a prayer group last night at the historical Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Charleston, South Carolina. He sat with the group for almost an hour before drawing his gun and killing nine people.
A witness quoted the man as saying, quote, "I have to do it. You rape our women and you're taking over our country and you have to go," end quote. Charleston Police Chief Greg Mullen called the shooting a hate crime. State and federal officials have opened a hate crime investigation into the attack.
The shooting suspect was arrested earlier today during a traffic stop in North Carolina. His Facebook page shows a picture of him wearing a jacket with white supremacist symbols on it.
Here with us to talk about the prevalence of hate crimes and hate groups in the U.S. is Phyllis Gerstenfeld. She's professor and chair of criminal justice at California State University Stanislaus and author of Hate Crimes, Causes, Controls, and Controversies. Phyllis, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
So we've been watching the details of this tragic crime emerge through the day. As we mentioned, it's being referred to as a hate crime. How do we define a hate crime? What sets a crime aside as a hate crime?
At its simplest level, a hate crime is any criminal act that's motivated by the victim's group, and certain groups qualify, including race, religion, sexual orientation, and so forth.
And is there usually an intent to not only perpetrate the crime against the direct victims, but send some sort of message to the community that they're part of?
There may or may not be, but hate crimes are unique in that it does have that requirement that there's a motive that's based on the particular victimization. And so in some cases, the perpetrator may be thinking of sending a larger message. In some cases, they're really reacting to a particular situation, but they're always motivated by the victim's group.
And how common are hate crimes, as far as we know, around the United States?
That's a really hard question to answer because probably a very large percentage of them go unreported. We have police data. We have other kinds of reports. We know that they're not terrifically common. Last year, actually the year before, the FBI reported about fewer than 8,000 hate crimes in the United States, which in the grand scheme of things isn't that many. But as I said, it's probably a really small proportion of what happens.
And we mentioned hate groups. Do we know how many of those we have in the United States, organized groups that we consider hate organizations, ones that might perpetrate hate crimes?
We have an estimate. As again, it's a really hard thing to measure, and it's hard to tell whether a group is one person or a large group of people. But there are organizations that try to track that, and the current estimates are there's somewhere around probably about 1,000 organized hate groups in the United States.
We're talking about hate crimes and hate groups in the aftermath of last night's shooting in Charleston, South Carolina. We have Phyllis Gerstenfeld with us, a professor of criminal justice at California State University, author of a book called Hate Crimes. Now, Phyllis, we, of course, don't know that much about the motive of the particular suspect in this shooting. It's unclear whether this was a lone wolf act or maybe part of some kind of organized group. How do organized hate groups operate? Do we see more of these lone wolf attacks today?
Most of the organized hate groups in the last 10 or 15 years or so have really tried to distance themselves from violence, at least on the face of it. They've tried to portray themselves as being nonviolent. Some of them will say, "Oh, we don't hate anyone. We just love our own race." So on the face of it, they often disavow these acts of violence. But you know, underneath there's a message there, and they these groups tend to put out a lot of things on the internet and other things. So there's a lot of use of media that they have to communicate. They engage in active recruitment efforts. So while they may not be actively promoting violence, there's sort of an underlying message there with some of them.
Is there, do you think, a hope maybe to inspire lone wolf action not directly connected with the actual group itself?
Yeah, that's in fact some of them actually spoken out saying specifically that because they don't want to be open to lawsuits and other kinds of things, and they do like to portray themselves as being not extremist. So they don't want to be directly affiliated. And I believe I've seen some reports that already some of the extremist groups have come out over the last few hours and said, "Oh, we had nothing to do with this guy." And so they try and distance themselves that way.
Now, these kind of attacks are more common than we'd like, but still, thankfully, very rare. Maybe so rare that we can't say there's a profile of the type of person who does this sort of thing. But from hate crimes we've seen, is there a common thread? Are there common things that we see case after case?
We tend to. Most hate crime perpetrators tend to be young men. Most of them tend to not have an extensive criminal history. What we see is that a lot of them are people who were really detached. They didn't have a lot of friends, and they see extremism kind of reached out to them as a way to make them feel like they belong somewhere, like they're empowered.
Now, sometimes the media paints a picture of a lone actor, a lone wolf attacker being mentally ill or having views that are drastically outside the norm, far beyond the pale. Is it oftentimes the case that mental illness of some sort is at play here?
In most cases, no. In most cases, it's really not that far beyond the pale. We have people whose behavior is obviously a lot more violent than what most people would do, and yet they're not really all that different from ordinary people in a lot of ways, unfortunately.
And bringing up the issue of mental illness, there's always the concern that attributing mental illness as a cause stigmatizes the people with mental illness who will never be involved in anything at all like this.
Exactly. The vast majority of mentally ill people are nonviolent and don't do things like this. So it's hard to make that association.
Now, some people have already pointed to similarities between this attack last night and one here in Wisconsin a few years ago at a Sikh temple in Oak Creek, Wisconsin. Do you see comparisons or similarities between the two from what we know so far?
From what we know so far, they seem similar in that we had a person who we know that the person who perpetrated the Sikh shootings was affiliated with white supremacist groups. He'd been in some bands and so forth. But we have here again a young man who sought out a religious organization and opened fire. So on the face of it, it seems very similar.
Now, I wanted to ask you about your thoughts on media coverage of cases like this. We're in the early stages here. It's easy to take maybe a sensationalist approach. It's a horrible crime, clearly, on the face of it. What do you see the media getting right and wrong when they cover stories like what just happened in Charleston?
I think one of the things that the media, everybody wants to know everything right away, and things unfold more slowly than people would like. There is a tendency to paint the perpetrators as being really aberrant, really, really different from everyone else, and I don't know that that's necessarily the case. There's always a lot of focus on how unusual they were, and I don't know that that's necessarily a particularly fruitful sort of thing.
Now, looking at the people who are victims of hate crimes, as you mentioned earlier, statistics are not solid on this, but do we know who the most common victims of hate crimes are as a group in the U.S.?
Yes, statistically, the most common victims of hate crimes in the U.S., at least from our reports, are African Americans, religious minorities, especially Jews and Muslims, and gay LGBT people. And also probably immigrants. Those numbers are particularly probably off because a lot of immigrants may be especially hesitant to contact authorities.
Now, from the research you've done on this topic over the years, are there things we could do from a legal standpoint or a societal standpoint to prevent future hate crimes?
From a legal standpoint, I mean, we've had hate crime laws in place now for 20 or 30 years in most states, and I don't think that, enacting laws or making the laws harsher are going to make any difference. We could put some tools in place to make them easier to use because there are very few hate crime convictions. I don't know nationwide data, but in California, for example, in an average year, there's far fewer than 100 hate crime convictions. So we could put some tools in place to do that, but I think really prevention would be a better line of inquiry. And, finding out who are these people who are vulnerable to these kinds of messages from the hate groups, and what can we do to avoid having them become violent.
Phyllis, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for asking me.
That's Phyllis Gerstenfeld, professor and chair of criminal justice at California State University, Stanislaus.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, will we see a new baby boom as Americans start having more children after the recent recession? We look at national and state population trends.
First, a bold plan for hiking in the Midwest and beyond. Our next guest, a former Wisconsinite, is making the case for a big trail. Really big, as in a marked path going around the coastlines of all the Great Lakes.
This would be a record breaker coming in at over 10,000 miles of trails. Melissa Scanlon had the idea, and she joins us now. She's Associate Dean of the Environmental Law Program, Director of the Environmental Law Center, and Associate Professor of Law at the University of Vermont. Melissa, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, could you tell us the inspiration? What got you to come up with this idea?
Sure. Actually, I came up with the idea while hiking a trail in Wisconsin, the Ice Age Trail. And I was thinking about all of the people who had to donate easements and the effort that went into contributing to that trail. At the same time, I was teaching water law and thinking about the state holding all of the coastlines of the Great Lakes in trust for the public, and realized that we have a walking trail along the coastlines of the Great Lakes that's held in trust already. The easement already exists, and it's just not recognized. So my proposal is to create a new national scenic trail. It would actually be a binational trail between the United States and Canada and all along the shores of the Great Lakes to pull together the whole region and really focus people's attention on the lakes.
Well, we already have various points of interest on the Great Lakes, Lake Superior in Michigan and Lake Erie. People can visit that way. What does a trail like this give us that just visiting a lake near you might not?
Well, you're right. We have a lot of fragmented trail efforts around the Great Lakes already. And my proposal is to link those together into a cohesive whole so that we can start to focus the public's attention on the Great Lakes as a region and use that as a way to attract tourism, walking-based and boating-based tourism around the Great Lakes, especially in areas that lack a lot of economic development. And it's a way to bring the public back into closer contact with the lake shores, which are really part of everyone's heritage.
Now, the legalities seem like they might be a little tricky. You say that there's a trust here held by the state around there, but there's a lot of property, a lot of shoreline private property. Wouldn't we need all of those landowners to sign on to this? Isn't that a tall order?
No, actually, we wouldn't. So there's something called the Public Trust Doctrine, which goes back before the Great Lakes states were even states. It was part of the Northwest Territory and the Northwest Ordinance, and talks about how all of the navigable waters are to be forever free. And that's been interpreted once in the Great Lakes to apply to walking, interpreted by the Supreme Court of Michigan. And the court in Michigan in Glass versus Geckel found that the public does have a right to walk on the coastlines of the Great Lakes between the water and what's called the ordinary high water mark, and that is a perpetual easement that the state holds in trust for the public. Now, that's the only state that's addressed that specific issue, so it's uncertain how other states will determine it, but certainly there's one state that has the most coastline of any of the states in the Great Lakes region that does recognize a public trust right to walk along the beaches.
How do you think landowners would take to that, those who didn't know about that rule that you just mentioned in one particular state?
Well, I think that part of the benefit of having a national scenic trail is to mark the ordinary high water mark. Some of the disputes that come up are around where the boundary is between public and private. And the benefit of having a trail would be to take away the mystery about where that line is, and also to clearly say what it is that the public can do there, which this would be a trail for walking. It's a rite of passage. It's not a place, it wouldn't be a place for camping or hanging out for the day, but really for passing through.
We're talking to Melissa Scanlon at the University of Vermont about a plan she had inspired in a hike on the Ice Age Trail here in Wisconsin to have a marked hiking trail along the shoreline of the Great Lakes, all of them, upwards of 10,000 miles of marked trails would be involved. So even if, in theory, this is legal, states could do this, somebody would have to take the lead on this. Do you see anyone taking the lead, making this a reality, given the realities of trying to get cooperation between all these states, provinces, and other governments?
Sure. And just one correction. I'm not with the University of Vermont, but Vermont Law School.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's a separate entity, but a common mistake. Yes, we need our modern-day Gaylord Nelson. And I think that that person remains to emerge, but we have a lot of terrific representatives in Congress and the Senate in the Great Lakes, and I'm confident that that there will be a coalition that emerges to support this.
Now, this has been an idea that has gotten a fair bit of excitement from people that you've approached on our Facebook page. People have responded positively. What are people saying to you about the idea of a trail like this?
I think it's an aha kind of moment for a lot of people that they think, well, that's really an obvious idea. It makes sense, and it would bring greater appreciation and awareness to the region. It could be a very low-impact, non-intrusive way to develop tourism around the Great Lakes. And so far, I've been hearing really positive responses to it. I think the proof will be in whether or not we can find congressional leaders, because it does take an act of Congress, two acts of Congress, actually, to get this done. The first would be authorizing a feasibility study to determine if it's something that really could happen. And then the next would be, based on that study, declaring it a national scenic trail.
Now, are you hopeful that this would have an impact on conservation for the lakes themselves?
I think ideally, the closer we are with our natural resources, the more aware we are of their value to us, and also to the threats to them when we come in closer contact. And I think that's really the benefit of having a trail. I mean, part of it is health and getting people out walking, but part of it will also, I think, benefit conservation and people's awareness about the both the beauty and the threats to the Great Lakes.
Do you think the Great Lakes ever get forgotten? I mean, there they are, sandwiched in the middle of North America between majestic oceans. Do people forget about the Great Lakes?
Well, it's called the flyover zone for a reason. Yes, that's why I think we need something like this to focus people's attention on what an awesome resource the lakes are for the region.
Now, you mentioned tourism. What kind of economic potential would you see for states if they got on board, and provinces if they got on board with this Great Lakes trail?
Well, I wouldn't speculate about dollar value, but the Appalachian Trail, for instance, has 3 to 4 million hikers a year, and the Great Lakes Trail would be three times longer than the Appalachian Trail, and it would go through a lot of urban areas, so it would be much more accessible. People could do shorter hikes on it, just small segments, and not be quite as isolated, or they could do longer hikes on it. And I think that with the technology that we have today to develop apps for smartphones that locate local businesses, there could be accommodations that spring up along the trail. There could be concierge-type services that take people's backpacks from segment to segment. There could be boat rental places that supply kayaks and canoes to traverse areas of hazards or to just paddle a particularly scenic part of the shoreline. So I think there's the potential for a lot of small businesses that could develop throughout the region.
Have you got a rough idea of the route that this trail would take?
Well, mainly the coastline where possible. On the Canadian side, they have the trail almost entirely completed, not on the coastline, but slightly up on the uplands. But in Canada, there's the waterfront trail that goes from Sault Ste. Marie to the St. Lawrence River towards Sault Ste. Marie. It's almost completed. And that's 870 miles of trail that is completed. And then there's another segment called the Voyager Trail that it goes from Thunder Bay reaching towards Sault Ste. Marie, and that's almost 700 miles of a biking and walking trail that's on the Canadian side.
So some of this is built already?
Yes, some of it's built. There's also a water trail effort around Lake Michigan that's focused on non-motorized boats and identifying all the access points and along Lake Michigan. So there are a number of efforts that exist, and the Great Lakes Trail would tie those together and then build the segments that don't currently exist.
So, Melissa, hypothetically, if and when all of this is in place, where would you be most excited to take some of your first hikes on this Great Lakes Trail?
Oh, that's a great question. Oh, let's see. I think the coastline around Door County is beautiful. That would be lovely. Hiking along Lake Superior along the bluffs would be fabulous. There are so many choices. The dunes around Indiana, the dunes in Michigan, there's so many options for people.
Well, Melissa, thanks so much for joining us and telling us about it.
All right. Well, thank you.
That was Melissa Scanlon, Associate Professor of Law at Vermont Law School, talking about our idea to create a hiking trail around the entire coast of the Great Lakes.
And you can share your thoughts on the idea over at the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. 6 years after the end of the recession, the economy continues to grow at a moderate pace. And one effect of the economic uptick is a rise in the number of births nationally.
According to data released yesterday by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, U.S. births increased by 1.4% last year. Seems maybe couples who put off having children for financial reasons may now consider adding to their families.
Although the birth rate increase is modest so far, some demographers are speculating that the nation may be poised for a baby bounce.
With us now is Kenneth Johnson, demographer at the University of New Hampshire and a visiting professor at the Applied Population Lab at the UW-Madison. Ken, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
So this baby bounce idea, now that we're coming back from the recession, we're going to see a significant increase in births in the U.S. Do you buy that?
Well, I think it's an open question right now. This is a very modest increase, and we're still 7 or 8% below what we were before the recession hit. So it is an uptick. It is significant, but we've got a long way to go.
Is it normal that birth rates track the economy? Economy down, birth rates go down, comes back up, they go up, or is this kind of a more recent phenomenon?
Well, the Great Recession that we've experienced is much more significant than any prior recession we've experienced. The only other thing that's even in the same ballpark as this is the Great Depression itself in the 1930s. And it took a long time for there to be a recovery from that recession. In fact, young women who began their childbearing years early in the Great Depression never did make up for the babies they didn't have during the Great Depression. So there's a lot left to be seen here about what's going to happen.
And looking at some of the charts that came out with this study, our birth rate, I mean, we're still well below when the baby boomers were being born. They were cranking out a lot of babies then.
Oh, yes.
There's more of us to have babies now, but the rate is nowhere near what it was.
No, ironically, even though there were many fewer women to have babies during the baby boom, they actually had they had more babies than we're having right now with this much larger population of women. And the recession hit the youngest women in their early 20s the hardest. And so the big question is whether those women will make up for the babies they didn't have or whether they're not going to have them at all. And that, if they have them, that'll be that baby bump that everybody's thinking about. If they don't have them, we won't see that.
And this is an amazing thing, this huge society-wide thing, but it goes down to a whole lot of individual decisions made person by person. So do demographers try to get at what's going on in the heads of the people who are deciding to have or not have babies given the current economy?
Generally not. That's a very difficult kind of question to ask, and we really don't have many tools to ask that question. So demographers tend to focus more on the numbers and how the numbers are changing. As you say, it is a very remarkable thing to see a society where all those individual decisions are being made produce a situation where we have a dramatic decline in the number of births, and it hits young women the hardest. Women in their 30s really are having babies roughly at the same rate that they did before the recession. It's really the women in their early 20s who have experienced this the most. And so by now, the women who were in their early 20s in 2007 are now getting into their later 20s. And so we should, in the next few years, be able to see whether or not this upturn is going to happen. There's just a little bit of evidence maybe of it happening right now, but we've got a long way to go.
We are talking birth rates in the United States. New report says they're going up for the first time since the Great Recession started. Ken Johnson, demographer, is with us. And for a look at how this is playing out in Wisconsin, we have David Egan Robertson on the line. He's also a demographer. He's with the Applied Population Lab at the UW-Madison. David, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me on.
So from what we know here in Wisconsin, are we mirroring these national statistics?
Yes, it's fairly reasonable to say that sort of as goes the nation, so goes Wisconsin in this case. The number of births in this recent report showing the 2014 births shows a slight increase from the prior year. But as Ken said, and our pattern has been the same since the start of the Great Recession, we're down from a peak of around 73,000 births in 2007 down into sort of the range of 66 to 67,000. So like the rest of the country, our number of total births has fallen off about 8% over that 6 to 7 year period.
You said for the most part, as goes the nation, so goes Wisconsin. Are there any factors that have made Wisconsin stand out over the years when it comes to birth rates?
And Ken, I think, kind of alluded to this as well, is that when you look back over 20-year period, 30-year period, there's just tremendous stability in terms of the number of births varied a little bit up and down depending on how many women were in their sort of prime childbearing years, but the sort of the fertility rate remained very constant for a period from like the mid-1970s up through about 2007, and then all of a sudden the whole game kind of changed with the start of the Great Recession.
Now, I know, and I'll bring Ken back in on this, in some other developed nations, lower birth rate is a big concern. It's an issue of national policy. Places in Europe, Japan, worried that they're not hitting the replacement rate. They're going to see a population decline, not enough young people to take care of the aging generations. How does the U.S. compare to that? How are we different, Ken?
Yeah, that's a good question. The U.S. fertility rates are considerably higher than they are elsewhere in the world, where our women in the United States have an average of about 1.9 babies each. In many European countries, the fertility rate is more like 1.3 or 1.4, 1.5. And they've worked very hard to try and encourage more women to have children with programs to provide them with paid leave and daycare facilities. So in that sense, their fertility rates are significantly lower than ours are. Now, our rates did drop somewhat during the recession. They dropped, as I was saying to you before, mostly for the youngest women. There were quite big differences between different racial groups. Hispanics, for example, experienced very significant declines in fertility, especially their people in their early 20s. The fertility rate for women in their early 20s who were Hispanic was down 34%. I mean, that's quite dramatic. More modest declines for whites and for blacks. So a lot of variability. The other point that is important is to realize that we're having these fewer births despite the fact that we have more women in their prime childbearing years right now than we had in 2007. So we're getting significantly fewer babies from more women of childbearing age. So that's just underscores how dramatic the drop in fertility was with the onset of the recession. And the marriage rates are down too. Most children are born, about 60% are born within marriage, and the marriage rates dropped as the recession began. So you asked me before whether demographers try to get into why individuals make decisions. Well, indicators like the fertility rate dropping dramatically for young women, the marriage rate dropping dramatically, underscores the fact that this is something that's affecting a very broad cross-section of the society. It's not just one or two groups. So it's a remarkably striking occurrence in modern American demographic history.
Well, and we've talked about that 20-something age cohort. I'm looking at charts for under 20, teen births, and really significant declines in that age group, plummeting in the 15 to 17 age bracket.
Yes.
And this is something that was going steadily down and really sharply down, it looks like, in the last few years, Ken.
Yes, and many groups are very happy to see that decline in teen pregnancy, since teenage mothers are the ones who have the most difficult time, with funds, and very often they're unmarried. So it makes it much more difficult and challenging for them to raise children. So generally, the decline in the fertility rates among teenagers is considered a good thing by almost everyone. So, one point, although the fertility rates have declined fairly significantly for them, they don't produce a very large share of the American births. So a big drop in their fertility rate is not going to produce a dramatic change in the number of children.
Interesting. And David, I wanted to ask you, are we seeing similar downturns in teen pregnancies here in Wisconsin?
Yes, that's true. Since 2007, the decline in terms of number of births to teens has actually fallen 40%. And as well, their fertility rate, what we call the age-specific fertility rate for teens, has also gone down 40%. And certainly it's part of a longer-term pattern, which stretches back to like the early 1990s when teen rates, birth rates began to fall, but it's been accelerated quite a bit over the last 6 to 7 years.
And David, I'm looking at charts here, 35 to 39-year-olds and 40 to 44-year-olds. Seems like births among those brackets inching up over the years fairly steadily.
Yeah, and those have held fairly constant, sort of all the age groups that you can break up the childbearing years into, and it's true in Wisconsin as well. There's been a slight decline during the Great Recession years, but it's very small compared to, as Ken pointed out, some of the really sizable changes that have been happening in parents in their 20s.
We're talking about how the improving economy is affecting birth rates in the United States, and we want to hear from you. Did the last recession scuttle or postpone your plans for having a family? Are you planning to start a new family or add on to your family, maybe now that the economy is getting a little better? What kind of factors do you consider in making that kind of choice? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue our conversation with demographers Kenneth Johnson and David Egan Robertson after this look at the news headlines with Noah Oshinsky.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking about a prospective baby boom as the economy improves and people consider having more children. And we'd like to hear from you. Did the recent recession put your plans for having children on hold? Are you considering adding to your family due to a better economic outlook? Are you maybe in wait-and-see mode? Well, you can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can tweet us. Our handle is Central Time WPR.
Kenneth Johnson and David Egan Robertson stay with us. They're both demographers, both affiliated with the Applied Population Lab at the UW-Madison. We'll go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. We've got Stephen on the line in Stevens Point. Stephen, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. This is really interesting to me because I feel like I'm right. I'm the exact person you're talking about, pretty much. I'm 28 years old. My wife is 28 years old. And we don't have kids yet, and we put it off because the recession, she had a hard time finding a job. She did find one now, and we're doing good in that respect. But I think the bigger factor for us was that between the two of us, we had $100,000 in student loans that we had to pay off before our life could really start. So when we graduated from university with our degrees, we had about $1,700 a month, $1,700 a month in student loan payments that previous generations just didn't have. And I think that is the real cause that we might have seen in a lot of these reductions in families, because it's basically putting an entire generation's life on hold for 5-10 years.
And Stephen, can I ask a personal question? Our demographers are wondering if people like you are now not going to have kids or are going to do it, but later than you might have. Where are you and your wife on this now?
Well, yeah, it's actually kind of funny because, you know, I was always kind of on the fence about having a family. And, you know, I would like it, but I could go without too, you know. And my wife was very, very wanting to have a family, and so I wanted to have a family too. Actually, just recently, she said something that scared me. She said, well, maybe we don't need to have one. I'm 28 years old now. It's getting to that point where we're at high risk, and it kind of worried me a little bit. I think we will. I'm confident that we will still have a family. But yeah, it did delay us by, you know, probably 10 years.
Stephen, thanks a lot for that call. And Ken, we've heard this from guests on related topics in the past, that this could be, demographically speaking, a lost generation. They don't have the money they feel to afford a family. They've got the student loan debt. By the time they do, they start thinking it's too late. Is this the kind of story, the kind of statistic you're going to be watching for?
Well, one thing I would say that might reassure them is that the average age at first birth for a woman right now is just about 28, so they would not be late relative to their cohorts in terms of when they had children. But yes, these issues of balancing work and family and debt are the kinds of issues that we at least suspect are factors in why there's been these delays in having children. And the question you asked was a very appropriate one. Are they, and the one that demographers like David and I are really wondering about, is this question of, are these just delayed births? Are they going to come a little bit later? Which would mean that all of a sudden you might have classrooms with a few more kids in them than you would have otherwise. Or are these going to be actual foregone births? And as I said to you near the beginning of the program, the cohort of women who was in their early 20s in 1930 never made up completely for the fact that they had delayed having children at the beginning of the Great Recession. In fact, they had that cohort who were in their early 20s in 1930 are the cohort that have had have more childless women in them, more women who never had children than any other cohorts before or since. So this is the big question, are whether couples like the one you just talked to going to just have these children a little bit later, or are they not going to have them?
Stephen, thanks for that call. If you are making that similar decision right now, we'd love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Did you put off having children during the Great Recession, maybe during your 20s? Are you trying to figure out if now is the time to do it? What has you on the fence? Which way are you leaning? 800-642-1234 is the number to call as we talk to demographers David Egan Robinson and Ken Johnson.
Rob, one point I wanted to make to you, just to give your listener an idea of the magnitude of this this birth dearth, is that I calculated what would have happened had women continued to have babies at the same rates that they were having them in 2007, just before the recession, which were not very high rates compared to the baby boom. And my calculation is that there are roughly 500,000 fewer births occurring right now than there would have been had the birth rates of the pre-recession period continued. So that's 500,000 fewer births out of about 4 million births. So we're talking about a significant number of children. I think around 2.8 million if we took the whole period from 2007 to 2014. So this is a significant number of children that haven't been born, and that's why demographers are so interested in this question of whether they're going to come late or they're not going to come.
And I wonder, David, if that's the case, this missing group, does that mean fewer workers to replace people as they retire in the future, fewer healthcare workers to take care of people as they age in the future? Are we going to have a shortage of people we need?
Yeah, it's a very good question, and it is a strong concern here in Wisconsin. It's been discussed by a number of economic development people at a state level. As you look out, particularly 25 or 30 years from now, that the size of the working age population will really not be much different in terms of numbers in like 2040 compared to what it was at 2010. So it is a concern, and I've done some birth projections as part of my work with the state's Department of Administration, And it's sort of a case where I was expecting a bit more of an earlier rebound in birth, but there has been this gap between what was projected for the last couple of years, between what was projected and what actually occurred in terms of number of births. So even we sort of look at these in our projection series in sort of 5-year chunks of time. So the number of births that have actually occurred from 2010 to 2015 is about 4% less than what was projected. So again, that always, you know, then you have to start thinking, okay, what's the population then going to look like 20 years from now and then 25 years from now when those people are entering the workforce?
Now, here's a crazy question, maybe from a non-demographer. From the perspective of the job you guys do, is there such a thing as a good birth rate, an ideal birth rate, something that we want to see, Ken?
Oh, I was afraid you'd ask me a question like that. Demographers generally aren't going to, at least I'm not going to get into a discussion like that. I mean, our job is mainly to try and understand what's happening to the population and maybe in David's case make educated guesses about what it might be in the future. I know I've done a lot of research on rural areas in the United States which have very low numbers of births, and in many counties, including some in northern Wisconsin, there are actually more people dying than being born. And I can tell you in communities like that people would like to see more births than they're having in those communities. So you know, again, it's the feelings in many communities is that they'd like to see more babies born than people dying. So you know, certainly these low birth rates are a concern in communities like that where there really aren't that many young women of childbearing age. So if the birth rates are down and the number of women of childbearing age is diminishing, as they are in many parts of rural America, including parts of northern Wisconsin, that becomes a very real concern locally. It means school districts are going to have to merge. It means that you know, towns are not going to have as much population as they would have had otherwise.
We'll leave it there. Kenneth Johnson, David Egan Robertson, thanks to both of you for joining us. Kenneth Johnson, demographer at the University of New Hampshire, visiting now at UW-Madison, and David Egan Robertson, demographer at the Applied Population Lab at UW-Madison.